Well, we're going to talk with another author now here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And this author, Casey Nagy, has a novel out now, a new novel. It's called Imagined Glories, and it's published by iUniverse. We're really pleased to have him with us today. I had a chance to read the book a few weeks back now, and I've read about six or eight books since then. But this one made an impression on me, and I enjoyed it very much. And I thought, boy, we should get Casey on to talk with him about his book. He, by the way, is the chief of staff to the provost and the chancellor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And, of course, the author of the book, Imagined Glories. And I'm certainly, if you'd like to join in as we move along here today and talk about there's a whole variety of issues that he takes up in his book here that are a lot of fun and interesting to talk about. I hope you will. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're in the Madison area, you can reach us at 263-1890. And you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Casey's a native of Washington State. He got his law degree at Seattle University School of Law, practiced maritime law in Seattle, relocated to Madison. He got a master's in anthropology from the UW and then practiced law and served as a municipal judge and joined the legal staff of the UW in 1991. And so he's been active in coordinating a lot of things, including political and public relations strategies for the university. Casey, welcome, by the way. Thanks for being with us today.
It's great to be here, Larry. Thanks.
I tell you what, and as I looked at your career, law degree, maritime law, you've been involved in public relations, and you've been a judge. A lot of that, a lot of that seems to be embodied in your book.
Funny how that works. You know, if I had to look at that same career trajectory and relate it to the book, I'd say that I have spent much of my life around conflict.
Yeah.
And trying to resolve it, trying to anticipate it, and also trying to understand it. And this was a theme I was interested in exploring in a more personal way. And that very much led into the themes that are developed in the book.
Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. Well, it's set in a rural Western Washington. Give us the setup for the book.
Sure. If you're familiar with Washington State, on the coastal side, there's a peninsula. It's the Olympic Peninsula, and there's a mountain range that runs down it like a backbone. And right at the tip of where the peninsula dives down into the lower part of Puget Sound, there's a small town called Port Townsend, and it was, at the turn of the 20th century, considered the gateway to Seattle and the Northwest because it was the most accessible port city. So you have pictures of square-rigged schooners stacked up for half a mile or better outside this coastal sea town, which had quite a reputation for sailors being waylaid, shanghaied, taken on voyages mm-hmm. they hadn't anticipated. It was quite a wild seaport, but a lot of the historic architecture has been preserved. And for a long time, Port Townsend was a very quiet, removed population where a lot of 60s people went to kind of do their own thing. And over the last 10 or 15 years, it's become discovered by folks with more money and different ideals. And I go back there with my family every year for a family reunion. And over time, we've seen that the unease emerge over what direction this community is going to go in. And these different values have run into conflict. And that, too, prompted my interest in using this particular setting, which I love, and grew up around as an important part of this book.
Well, it's it really is an interesting, really interesting area, and I think you see some of that in other parts of this country as well. That sort of conflict areas that even in Wisconsin, I think there are places where you see the conflict of people who have, for example, let me just. In general, say northern Wisconsin on many of the lakes and in those areas where there were you know, people have lived their whole life there, and now there are a lot of new people coming in.
Right.
And building large homes and with a different set of values.
Absolutely. I think you see it in many places in the country. If you go into Montana, much of the formerly inaccessible wilderness now is spotted with large homes and property that's fenced off from where you used to be able to roam pretty freely. And I do think you see these conflicts, or at least the emotions, beginning to erupt in many places around the country. And, you know, we have law enforcement, we have government, but largely we have order by the consent of the governed. And part of that conflict that is emerging, I wondered what happens if the consent of the governed is withdrawn, at least by some sector of the population. How do people respond to that? It's something I think we need to pay some attention to.
Yeah, I think you're right. Well, in your case, and in your book, which is fiction, of course, we've got Henry Ivers.
Yes,
Henry Ivers is the sheriff of this town, and some bad things happen. Even to Henry.
A little bit
to him, but to that whole area.
He's an ordinary guy, kind of an aging sheriff in a town where not a whole lot happens. And has a history as a logger, grown up around the peninsula country of the Northwest. And if you're familiar with the area, you know, people just sort of have settled beliefs. They do good works. They do the best they can with their kids. They don't understand all the time where their kids are going. If they go off to school, things people here can identify with as well as out there. And what happens when a person of that background and sort of common expectations suddenly sees the social order for which he's responsible begin to disintegrate for reasons that at first are masked in a variety of different ways intentionally? And then what happens when the initial conflict that results from intentional acts spirals into a bit of a conflagration, a bit different from the Peshtigo fire, but a similar theme? And how does an individual respond to that, and in ways that he never would have anticipated or predicted? And what loyalties does he draw on to family, to community, to professional responsibility? It's a complicated mix, and I found it fascinating to write about.
Yeah, it was fascinating to read about, too, I'll tell you that. Casey Nagy is our guest today. He's the author of the novel Imagined Glories. It's published by iUniverse, and we're really pleased to have him with us today. If you have a question or comment as we move along here today, as we talk about his book and the sort of delicate balance of government and the people, and when you have a period of crisis, chaos, we'd welcome your calls at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or in the Madison area, you can reach us at 263-1890, 263-1890, or email us at talk@wpr.org. You're a busy guy. You've got a lot of work, and just started to step back from the story for a minute. I'm wondering, how in the heck's a guy have time to write this? But I suppose it's like a lot of us who have jobs. If you really want to do something, you find a way to do it.
You do. Let me say, as my kids would say if they were asked, I was working on this for a long time. It's been over 10 years. The inscription is to my children, and it says, "Hey, guys, I finished my book." And I finished the story many years ago and then continued to rewrite it. And each time I'd emerge with a declaration that I was finished, they grew more and more dismissive. And so that's why the inscription reads the way it does. But it became, apart from I've always loved writing, and I wanted to see if I could tell a story in a way I liked, and it was a story that I believed in. But at the same time, in a life that's busy with family and professional obligations like all of us have, we all need to find a little place that we can go to just to be reflective or creative or quiet. And this, for me, became that place where no matter what the tumult or what source it might have, I could always keep in mind that I'd be able to go back to that place where I was in control at some point. And so it was protective and cathartic as well as everything else.
Rodney in Hudson has a comment or question. Rodney, hi. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, gentlemen. I lived in Snohomish County, Judge, for 35 years, and I'm kind of a demographic kind of guy.
Great.
Two things that I've noticed about Snohomish and the little town of Snohomish is that it's basically been taken over by a group of Tennessee people, that they're a few families moved there, and then through the years they just added more families. And the town is essentially, I think they were written in the New York Times as it became a town of brawls. They brought that culture from Tennessee into the little town of Snohomish. And then the second issue, and maybe you've heard of this as well, is with the Enron case. The Snohomish County PUD just paid off Enron $29 million, even though they felt they weren't responsible for that debt. But they said to the people of Snohomish, hey, it's cheaper to pay Enron than it is to fight them in court. And I'll let you have your opinion there.
Sure, thank you. I had not heard of the Enron settlement, but as a lawyer, I can't take issue with the fact that it is sometimes more expedient to pay than to fight. You often end up losing in many ways, apart from financial. My sister lives in Snohomish. I had not heard from her about the Tennessee connection, but I have heard over the years her dismay over how a small community has had to adjust to an influx of people with, you know, whether it's from Tennessee or California, anywhere else, a different set of values, but more important, a different set of expectations, and often with the financial means to impose those expectations on local community government and ways of doing business. And that's been very distressing for her, and it's part of the kind of transitional conflict that Larry and I were describing earlier.
Yeah. Thanks very much for calling, Rodney. Appreciate it. Casey Nagy, our guest from Madison, chief of staff to the provost and the chancellor of the UW-Madison, and he has written a book, Imagine Glories, and we're talking about it here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Casey Nagy of Madison, chief of staff to the chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I had also added the provost earlier, but he's not the chief of staff to the provost. Provost has his own, but Casey's the chief of staff to the chancellor of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, but he's the author of the book, the novel Imagined Glories, and I had a chance to read it a few weeks back, and I enjoyed it very much, and really pleased to have him with us today to talk about his book. It's set in rural western Washington. We've got a sheriff, Henry Ivers, is kind of thrown into the midst of a mess. Some, probably, so you might say, escalating chaos as we've got some marine and timber businesses. We've got some Native American activists. We've got an anti-government militia group all playing a role in the story. And as we said, there's all kinds of issues that come to the fore in this. Young people's disenchantments with things, federal intervention into local issues, ethnic divisions, media, terrorism, all play a role. And family and community values, I think you could also add to that, mix of things that he manages to cover and talk about in this novel, and you'd think, how is he going to get all that in? Well, he does manage to do a very nice job of getting it all in. You may have some questions or comments either about those issues that we've been talking about, about the book. Glad to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234, or in Madison at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call. And Casey, before we go back to the phones, we'll get to Mark and Racine here in just a minute. But you've had, obviously, in your role with the chancellor, you've had an opportunity to observe a lot of young people, a lot of smart young people. Mm-hmm. And young people, the disenchantment of some young people plays a role in your book. And sort of an activist role, and maybe in a negative sense. What did you draw on from your experiences to bring that to bear in the book?
Well, a couple of things. Activism has sort of bookended my life in certain respects. When I was in sixth grade in Seattle, we were looking out the window of my elementary school, which is right in the shadow of the I-5 overpass, right by the University of Washington campus. And 20,000 students swarmed onto the interstate and closed it down. This is 69 or 70, and I thought, well, this is a fairly impressive display. And at the same time, my teacher, who I revered, best teacher I ever had in my life, was one of these old-style teachers who'd, you know, hit you with a ruler and eraser if you weren't paying attention. And she instructed us that anybody seen looking out the window would be expelled by the end of the day. So you had a kind of clash of perspective, which left an indelible imprint. And then, through my professional time here at the university, you come into contact a lot with student energy and passion and, you know, the frustration over conversation. As an administrator, you're always looking out at all the variables, and you try to explain how they all fit into the discussion that's taking place. And students are impassioned about a particular issue, and, you know, they're only here for a certain period of time. They're not interested in the nuances of why we can or can't do certain things. They want action. And so there's tension that suffuses a lot of conversation between students and administration, and it's a good tension. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there's always an element of volatility associated with it. You see out in California right now some really horrendous acts in terms of animal rights protests going on, and we've seen our history of somewhat physical, if not violent, exchanges here on campus over labor-related issues and sweatshop-related issues. So I think that volatility is there, and part of what I wanted to explore was what happens if there's a certain intentionality associated with that volatility that can drive a wedge between some of the compacts we rely on to keep social order. What would that look like, and how would people respond to it? Because as a person and also as a parent and an administrator, it's something I worry about, and particularly worry about it given what we've earlier discussed relating to transitional emotional conflicts taking place in communities throughout the country.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Mark in Racine has a question or a comment. Mark, hi.
Hi. This might be a question or a comment. Your book, I gather, kind of relates to a sort of crisis in government related to cultural changes. I think that for quite a number of years now, we've had the government doing essentially the opposite, where they create perceived crises in order to change the culture and to persuade the culture to do things that they might not otherwise want to do and might not be in their best interest. I was wondering if you would have any comments on that.
Sure. Great question. And in part, I think what you've observed prompted me to begin writing this book. I hear a lot from students, from my children, and from others, a great deal of dissatisfaction with the way government often uses or employs a rhetoric that embraces the us versus the they or the them as a convenient way of focusing attention on matters that are somewhat abstract or distant, and therefore encourages us to ignore some of the more immediate or local kinds of issues that we're actually experiencing on a day-to-day basis. And in my book, at least, I explore from the part of students the resentment that they have toward that kind of subterfuge, that we may well have international issues, but there is not an us, which is singular.
Mm-hmm.
And the more we lose sight of that fact, the less time we have in which to deal with some of the issues that the diversity that exists everywhere is going to push toward the forefront.
Yeah. A couple of more things here. When I was going to school in the 1950s, I was taught that in Rome, somebody had said or had figured out that if you can't give them bread, give them circuses. And I think we're being supplied with a lot of circuses. And I had something else, but I'm...
it went away. Well, that happens to me, too, once in a while, Mark, so don't feel bad. Casey, Connor?
I don't disagree. I think a couple of things come immediately to mind, which I relied on in the book in the telling of the story. One is the interest of government in focusing our attention on matters that are convenient to government, and the inclination of the media, given some of the difficulties in subscription and other ways of remaining vital and economically sustainable, of moving toward entertainment-based news. That represents a dangerous synergy between a government or other entity attempting to attract our attention to matters of intentional emphasis and the willingness of the sources of information we rely on to take us there. And when you say we're being given a bunch of circuses, I think that contributes to that phenomenon.
Yeah.
I think that part of our problem is, well, we've had a tremendous loss of editorial diversity in this country, and another thing is that news is being collected essentially by brokers now, who rely upon media sources to give them the news, and so there's not much investigative reporting done. So,
I think that's certainly true, and I think one of the added complications that we're experiencing now, we haven't quite figured out what to do with, is the secondary and tertiary levels of conversation that take place on the basis of this somewhat packaged news or packaged information. You have blogs going 24 hours a day. You have chat lines going 24 hours a day. And each level of remove from the original package takes on a reality of its own because none of them from the outset are fully grounded.
Yeah.
And that contributes to a maelstrom of conflicting views and emotions about quote-unquote facts when it's difficult to find out what the full body of facts are.
Yeah. Thank you, Mark.
Sure.
Yeah, appreciate the call very much. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And just to get back to the book, to sort of lay a little more of the groundwork of the book, we've talked sort of broad terms for the most part about it, but there are some violent acts that take place in this community that the sheriff, Henry Ivers, has to respond to.
Yes. Do you want me to go into those?
Well, a little bit of the flavor.
Sure. I mentioned earlier this is a relatively quiet area. You have the small incidents of break-ins and things that take place, but you don't often have large crime in Jefferson County, Washington. And in rapid succession, some destructive acts take place involving fishing vessels and a whale touring industry and a mill, which are seemingly unrelated, but then appear to have a connective motif that relates to Northwest Native American tribal traditions. And so there's an early examination of whether we have some kind of renaissance of Native American activism in the region, which previously has experienced very significant dispute over tribal fishing rights and logging and timber rights and things of that nature, and whaling rights of the Mackay Indians in Northwest Washington. And so there's an examination of whether this represents a new age of activism. And then it slowly bleeds into indicators that maybe that's not the case, and maybe there's some kind of impetus that is emanating out of the University of Washington and students there. And then you have some additional features come into play that are opportunistic in nature, and have some relationship to those original events. And I guess I don't want to go too much into it, but, no, but they all, I think, fold together.
Yeah, they do that. But I wanted to have I want our listeners to have sort of a view of how it an overall view of how the book lays out. And you get federal intervention into this, and it's not very well. People aren't pleased
it's
about it.
It's not appreciated.
Yeah, well, that's...
Well, that's not universally true, probably, but I try to... I think anytime you have different jurisdictions of professionals, whether it's law enforcement or what have you, there's professional pride and different ways of doing things that can run into conflict when they're forced together. And I think a lot of that has been, if not abated, at least... smoothed over the cooperation that's developed with interagency cooperation post 9/11. I think a lot of effort has gone into making more seamless the cooperation, but you still have the on-the-ground tensions. And when federal authorities come in with their ideas about how to handle things in your community, naturally, as the law enforcement officer responsible for that community, you're conflicted. And that's a part of the emotional aspect of the book, but it also results in some different choices that need to be made with respect to what's right for the community and what kind of timing and what kind of resolution is acceptable.
Yeah, I was taken back a little bit when you said you were in sixth grade when there was the marching on the interstate in Washington. I was a student here at the university, and when the National Guard was called in, and during the student riots, rioting of that time in the mid-60s, or about the mid-60s, I guess it was. So there was a lot of that tension going on, right here.
I think anybody who's lived or worked here for a time has been impressed by the history of public concern at this university and in this community. It's part of where its energy comes from, I think.
Yeah, I think you're right. What about student activism today? I would contrast it back to the 60s and maybe in the 70s with today. Do you think, seems like people, I've had people say to me at least, you know, students don't seem to be quite as emotional or involved as they were maybe back those years back. And I don't know if that's true or not. What do you think?
Well, I should be careful or they'll end up on my doorstep tomorrow morning. I think here's how I'd characterize the difference, just in my personal perspective. I think there were very obvious and global focal points for earlier periods of public dissent. You had the Vietnam War and a draft.
Yeah.
You had the emergence of the civil rights insistence, and you had feminism. You had a number of things that were clear, global, and compelling. Today, you don't really have that kind of emotive singular issue that can draw everybody together in common cause. You have a much more diffuse range of passions. You have people who are concerned about the war. You have people concerned about overseas investments. You have people concerned about the Middle East and Israel versus Palestine. You name it. There's a people concerned about Myanmar. What's happening there? So. What you find often when there is a protest or some degree of activism is an alignment of multiple groups who are involved in these different areas of dissent or activity or activism, but they group together because they're all concerned. They're not necessarily concerned about the same issue, but they're concerned, and it brings them a certain degree of critical mass. But they don't have that on their own. So I think that's one difference, is it's more diffuse now. I think another is passions just have so many places to be directed. There's a lot of concern mm-hmm. about politics. I think if you look at the current election, you can see that student activism is alive and well.
Yeah.
They are energizing whole state populations over this election, and a lot of that's due to their ground roots efforts, whatever the political stripe. So the energy's there. I just think it's not as concentrated as it's been in the past.
Yeah, I think you're right. I was going to bring up the elections because it certainly seems that students have particularly, well, of course, this campus, I'm thinking about this campus, particularly Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton, both have very passionate supporters of young people.
As does Mr. Huckabee and Senator McCain. I think, yeah. You know, they're it's probably obvious that a university, this university community, has a more vocal Democratic orientation than Republican. But I think you have the same level of energy and passion among those who are in the different camps. It just may be a numbers difference, but they're here.
Yeah. Terrorism comes to play in your book. And, you know, as I thought about that, too, I thought, you know, how much easier would it be for We tend to focus our thoughts on New York and 9/11 and the big cities, but a place like Madison or Eau Claire or La Crosse might be a little bit more related to your book, just in terms of its location and maybe its size. Oh, it's actually a little bigger than
a little bit big, yeah.
a little bit bigger. But how terrorism could be. Could be so much easier to deploy in a place. You kind of show that in your book a little bit, too.
Well, yes. And you know, as a parent of a student here, as a member of this community and as an administrator, this is what you're afraid of. You know, we're all wounded by the incidents at Northern Illinois, at Virginia mm-hmm. Tech, at other schools that have experienced these random acts of violence. But if you were considering a terrorist act, this is where people send their kids, and there isn't any more vulnerable place, in my estimation, than that in this society. And so we spend a lot of work, enormous energy and collaboration with different law enforcement jurisdictions to try to ensure as best we can that we're not vulnerable to that kind of action here or on any other campus. But it's what makes you afraid at night.
Yeah, it sure does. And one of the other areas I haven't touched on that I had notes on, I just sort of jotted down here, was family and community values and how that can – I guess we have kind of talked about that a little bit, but just from your book, how does family and community values play into your book?
Strongly, in part the you know, there's a little autobiographical component to any book, and
sure.
and you explore your relationships with your children. My daughter's, you know, exploring young adulthood here mm-hmm. as a student. She was a student out at the University of Washington before coming here, and the kinds of separation anxiety that take place, and the divergence in political. Orientation and things of that nature, particularly if you had a first-generation child go off to school, which I hear and see every day at the campus. Yeah. It was interesting to explore the features of that kind of family loyalty and family and you know, the increasing complexity mm-hmm. of what constitute family values in a context like that. And then community, we all want to be invested. And when things happen to the environment in which we've become invested, you find yourself often having to make decisions using factors that if you sat back and thought about it, you'd never rely on and you wouldn't yeah. think they'd ever come to mind. But in yeah. the moment, they do. And that's somewhat sobering if you go through that exercise. You realize what you might do in certain circumstances that in the abstract, you'd never consider.
Consider, yeah. Well, you're going to be doing a book signing coming up, are you not?
Yes. I had one scheduled for last Monday, and through the really gracious efforts of the University Bookstore here in Madison. And early in the morning, they called it off because of the big snowstorm that never came. And so they've rescheduled it for Monday, March 10th at 7 o'clock at the Hilldale University Bookstore.
Hilldale University Bookstore in Madison. Chance to meet Casey Nagy and get a copy of his book. And, of course, you can get a copy even if you don't go to the signing. But you may not get with his signature on it. Casey, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so
much. Thank you, Larry. I really appreciate you having me.
Appreciate it very much. Casey Nagy, who is the chief of staff to the chancellor of the UW-Madison and also the author of the book Imagined Glories. It's published by iUniverse. And it's a real pleasure to talk with him. It's a lot of fascinating things, as we've been talking about, that get covered in the book. And I think you're going to enjoy it. I certainly did. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network.